Today is Monday, the 29th of June, and this is the World Socialist Website. The Earthquake Disaster in Venezuela, A Crime of U.S. Imperialism, by Andrea Lobo. The death and suffering inflicted upon the people of Venezuela by the June 24 double earthquakes has laid bare a massive international crime by U.S. imperialism, which prepared this catastrophe through a century of colonial domination. The Trump administration is now seizing upon the disaster to accelerate a U.S. military occupation it launched with the January 3 invasion to capture sitting President Nicolas Maduro. By Sunday, the official confirmed death toll has risen to 1,430, while the UN's Humanitarian Coordination Office has received unconfirmed reports that up to 50,000 people may be missing. An analysis of satellite images published in El País found that the destruction follows precisely the line of the San Sebastian Fault. From Catia La Mar through La Guaira and the International Airport to Carabaida, a densely populated coastal corridor. Decades of warnings about catastrophic seismic hazard and the need to rebuild or reinforce buildings according to modern engineering standards went entirely unheeded. 4 days after the earthquake, families are still digging through reinforced concrete with machetes, crowbars, hydraulic car jacks, and bare hands. Rescuers report hearing children crying beneath the rubble until the sounds stop amid the unbearable smell of corpses. Child survivors arrive at hospitals alone, identified only by adhesive tape with their names on their wrists, while hospitals and morgues overflow with victims. Quote, "No machinery has arrived, nothing," one Catia La Mar resident said Friday. Quote, "We are without power, without water. The apartment blocks have begged to be evacuated because the damage is so severe," end quote. A woman who lost everything in Caracas told reporters, quote, "Nobody has come to tell us anything about shelter. Here, everything is up to the neighbours," end quote. The thousands who have died are victims not merely of a natural catastrophe. The decrepit state of Venezuela's housing stock, the collapse of its healthcare system, the degradation of its electrical grid, and the incapacity of the state to organise any meaningful emergency response are the product of the semi-colonial oppression of Venezuela by US imperialism since the Venezuela crisis of 1902 to 1903. In that crisis, a fleet of German, British, and Italian warships bombarded Venezuelan ports over unpaid debts. President Theodore Roosevelt intervened, not to defend Venezuelan sovereignty, but to assert that if any Latin American nation required disciplining, the United States would do it. The conflict gave rise to the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, arrogating to Washington the exclusive right to exercise, quote, "international police power," end quote, in the Western Hemisphere. Washington swiftly applied this doctrine in Venezuela, engineering a regime change operation in 1908 that installed the dictator Juan Vicente Gomez, who ruled until 1935 through torture, chain gangs, and mass executions, while handing vast oil concessions to the Rockefellers, Standard Oil, and other U.S. corporations, transforming Venezuela into the world's largest oil exporter. Washington subsequently backed yet another brutal dictatorship under Marcos Perez Jimenez, whose secret police imposed a reign of terror through assassinations, disappearances, and concentration camps. For services rendered in suppressing the masses, President Eisenhower bestowed upon Perez Jimenez the Legion of Merit. The nationalization of the oil industry in 1976 changed nothing fundamental. The same structures, the same US corporate subsidiaries, and the same single commodity dependency remained. When oil prices collapsed in the late 1980s, President Carlos Andre Perez imposed IMF-dictated shock therapy, triggering the Caracazo uprising met by martial law and the summary execution of protesters in the streets. The election of Hugo Chavez in 1998 provoked mounting hostility from Washington, culminating in a US-backed coup in April 2002 that briefly deposed him before mass protests forced his reinstatement. Following Chavez's death and Nicolas Maduro's succession, the Obama administration declared Venezuela a national security threat and imposed punishing sanctions. The US economic war escalated relentlessly under the first Trump administration and was maintained by Biden, deliberately strangling Venezuela's capacity to import machinery, spare parts, medicines, food, and construction materials. UN special rapporteurs concluded that the sanctions regime produced mass suffering and contributed to over 100,000 excess deaths. All of this culminated in the events of January 3, 2026, when the Trump administration dispatched special forces to abduct President Maduro in what amounted to an unprovoked war of aggression to gain control over oil and key minerals. In the 6 months since, Venezuela has been transformed into a semi-colonial protectorate under the so-called Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. Laws rammed through the Chavista-led National Assembly have surrendered the world's largest proven oil reserves and major gold deposits to Washington and its corporate partners. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent stated publicly, quote, "The United States is directing policies in Venezuela at the moment," end quote. The collapse of dozens of buildings on June 24 and the wholly inadequate emergency response can only be explained by this century of semi-colonial oppression. While selfless rescue teams from the US and other countries will save lives, Washington has primarily sent a military invading force. Two US warships, the USS Fort Lauderdale and the USS Billings, are deployed in Venezuelan waters. Five C-17 Globemaster transport aircraft are ferrying a contingency response element to take over management of Simon Bolivar International Airport from Venezuelan aviation authorities. MV-22 Ospreys, UH-1Y Super Huey helicopters, and Army CH-47 Chinooks pre-staged on Curaçao complete the picture. This military footprint is entirely consistent with the operations that Washington and the government headed by the US puppet, acting President Delcy Rodriguez, have already been conducting jointly in Venezuela's interior. US and Venezuelan forces have bombed and swept through the gold and coltan mining zones of the Orinoco Arc to clear informal miners and secure control by the mining transnationals. Operations that included the extrajudicial killing of Hector Guerrero Flores, the alleged Tron de Aragua leader. Late Thursday, Major General Kevin J. Jarrett of the U.S. Marine Corps arrived in Caracas to direct Southcom's operations and to become the de facto colonial administrator. Rodriguez, in turn, appointed Major General Juan Ernesto Zulbarán Quintero of the Bolivarian National Guard as sole authority for the emergency. The disaster zone covering the Caracas metropolitan and surrounding areas is under military command, 6 months after a US invasion. The parallel with the Haiti earthquake in 2010 is chilling. Then Washington exploited a catastrophic earthquake to deploy 20,000 troops, seize control of Port-au-Prince Airport, and imposed direct military administration over a country it had dominated for a century. Relief planes from Médecins Sans Frontières, carrying desperately needed medical equipment, were turned away from a US-controlled airport while patients died. The mission was not a rescue, it was an occupation. The political analyst Ricardo Rios of the Caracas consultancy firm Poda and Estrategia stated what bourgeois commentators rarely acknowledge so plainly. The earthquake, quote, is going to be very well exploited to increase the presence of the United States and its control over Venezuela, and also for Rodriguez to lean on the United States as her primary ally, end quote. Trump himself provided the most revealing statement of colonial arrogance. In a speech following the earthquake, the would-be U.S. Führer declared, quote, Venezuela has been fantastic. We have a great relationship. It was a one-day war, we hit them so hard, and now we've taken out millions of barrels of oil and we've paid for the war many times over. It is a happy country again. The people are happy. They are dancing in the streets, end quote. Prior to the U.S. invasion, Venezuela's economy had contracted by roughly 80% in a decade, driving more than 8 million people to flee the country. The sanctions regime, maintained across Democratic and Republican administrations alike, killed far more Venezuelans through deliberate economic deprivation and set the stage for the disaster following Wednesday's earthquakes. At the same time, the dead of La Guaira and Caracas are also the victims of the historic bankruptcy of bourgeois nationalism and its Bolivarian variant. The Chavista governments of Hugo Chavez, Nicolas Maduro, and now Rodriguez held power for nearly three decades, presiding over one of the greatest surges in oil revenue in history. They proclaimed a Bolivarian revolution and socialism of the 21st century. Yet the concrete and adobe apartment blocks that pancaked on Wednesday night, many of them rebuilt after the 1999 Vargas catastrophe without seismic engineering, stand as a monument to what that socialism actually delivered. A government genuinely placing human life first would have used those years of petroleum wealth to systematically retrofit and rebuild the country's housing stock to modern seismic codes, fortify its hospital system, and develop emergency preparedness systems capable of responding to a catastrophe that scientists had explicitly predicted. The social conditions that turned a seismic event into a mass grave were prepared by a century of imperialist plunder, decades of sanctions, and a corrupt bourgeois nationalism that subordinated the working class to the needs of Wall Street. The dead of Venezuela are the victims of a class crime. The governments now dispatching rescue teams to Venezuela stood idly by or became directly complicit in the US efforts to subdue the country through mass hunger, disease, and suffering. Rosa Luxemburg, writing in 1902 about the eruption of Mount Pelee that killed 40,000 in Martinique, gave eloquent expression to the character of such moments. She described the imperialist powers that rushed to offer aid to the survivors after inflicting far more death over decades of oppression as, quote, weeping carnivores and beasts in Samaritan's clothing, end quote. Luxemburg concluded her essay with a vision of the coming reckoning, a volcano of social revolution that would sweep away the oppressive social order, after which humanity would at last confront its only true and final enemy, quote, blind, dead nature, end quote. Earthquakes and other natural phenomena do not choose their victims. It is the social order based on capitalist profit and imperialist domination that determines who dies. The working class in Venezuela and internationally must take matters into its own hands, organising independent rank-and-file relief committees to mobilise the resources necessary for effective rescue and humanitarian aid efforts, while demanding the expropriation of all the ill-gotten gains of US corporations from the historic plundering of Venezuela and Latin America to rebuild on the basis of social equality. US strikes Iran again as Trump threatens a country, quote, will no longer exist, end quote, by Andre Damon. US warplanes bombed Iranian coastal radar and air defense sites on Friday and again on Saturday, striking 10 targets near the Strait of Hormuz in the second wave. The US attacks are the latest in a series of military escalations since the announcement of a ceasefire on June 17, when US President Donald Trump signed a Memorandum of Understanding with Iran at Versailles. After ordering Saturday's strikes, Trump threatened to annihilate the country. The United States, he wrote, quote, will be forced to militarily complete the job that we very successfully started. If that happens, the Islamic Republic of Iran will no longer exist, end quote. As he has done repeatedly, Trump is using genocidal language, threatening to annihilate a country and exterminate large portions of its population. As with his earlier outbursts, the vow to make Iran no longer exist carries an implicit threat to use nuclear weapons. The attacks and threats come amid a deepening political crisis within the American ruling class over the ceasefire Trump announced on June 17. In the 11 days since, the deal has come under sustained attack from dominant sections of both the Republican and Democratic parties, which have denounced it as a surrender to Tehran. Republican Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, said it, quote, negotiates away the victories, end quote, of the war. The Democrats condemned the agreement as having failed to secure the interests of US imperialism. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said that under the deal, quote, Iran is stronger and America is less safe, end quote. Over the weekend, as the bombing resumed, the demands across the political establishment for an escalation of the war only sharpened. On Sunday, the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, a major voice of American finance, declared in its headline that, quote, Iran is winning the Battle of Hormuz, end quote, and called on Trump to escalate. It dismissed the renewed US strikes as love taps. The regime, the board concluded, quote, is leaving the president a choice, surrender Hormuz to Iranian terror or fight for it, like he always should have once he started the war, and reopen the strait by force, end quote. The debacle of the war has produced a deepening crisis within the Republican Party. Last week, Trump berated the Republican senators who had voted to halt the war, and Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana shouted back at him behind closed doors. On CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday, Cassidy, who leaves the Senate in January, pointed to the extent of the defeat confronting US imperialism. Quote, a medium-sized power at this point is perceived to have fought a superpower to a draw, he said, quote, requiring some measure of accommodation of we, the superpower, and we spent $29 billion, and we have 13 Americans dead. We hope to get back to status quo ante, end quote. In reality, Iran has inflicted substantial damage on the US military. The fighting escalated throughout the week. Iran struck the cargo ship Ever Lovely with a drone in the Strait of Hormuz on Thursday and a tanker carrying Qatari crude on Saturday, each drawing US strikes in return. Early Sunday, Iran's Revolutionary Guard fired ballistic missiles and drones at the Ali al-Salem Air Base in Kuwait and the US 5th Fleet Headquarters in Bahrain. The Guard said it had, quote, destroyed eight important infrastructures of the child-killing US Army, end quote. A US official told CBS News on Sunday that no Iranian missile or drone had reached its target and that there were, quote, no US injuries or impacts on US assets, end quote. The statement is in line with earlier US denials about the extent of US military casualties. 2 days earlier, the Wall Street Journal had published satellite evidence that Iran's strikes over the four-month war devastated the Fifth Fleet's home base far beyond anything the Pentagon had admitted. The Fifth Fleet headquarters, a $200 million building, was left no longer usable. A dozen other buildings, two satellite communications terminals, the barracks and the main dining hall were hit. And rebuilding the Bahrain base alone, the paper estimate, would cost some $400 million. Across the region, more than 20 US sites had been struck, with damage running into the billions. The Pentagon sought to cover up the scale of the damage. The Trump administration pressed commercial satellite companies to restrict access to images of the destruction and declined to give Congress the cost. By mid-March, the Navy had quietly evacuated 1,500 sailors and their families from Bahrain to Norfolk, Virginia, and the military is now weighing whether to rebuild the base, move its command centers underground, or withdraw from the Gulf altogether. Iran has also strengthened its hold on the Strait of Hormuz. Its foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, Trump's chief negotiating partner, declared on Sunday that under the agreement, Iran alone is responsible for managing the strait and that, quote, no other country has any responsibility in that regard, end quote. The toll has been staggering. By mid-June, Iran's health ministry put its dead at more than 3,400, among them 376 children. 13 US troops have died, six of them army reservists killed by a single drone at Port Shuaibah in Kuwait. The Pentagon put the direct cost at $29 billion. On June 24, the White House asked Congress for an $87.6 billion supplemental, most of it to replenish the military. The war has engulfed Lebanon as well. Since the fighting spread there on March 2, Israel's bombardment and ground invasion have left 4,246 dead and more than 12,000 wounded, the Lebanese health ministry says, and forced more than 1 million people, a fifth of the population, from their homes. By late April, the Lebanese government had counted more than 62,000 homes damaged or destroyed, with entire villages in the south levelled. A ceasefire that took effect on April 16 never held. Israeli strikes continued through every renewal. Five Israeli divisions remain inside southern Lebanon, and a framework deal announced on June 26 was rejected within a day by Hezbollah's Naim Qassem as null and void. Despite the scale of the disaster inflicted on US imperialism, dominant sections of the political establishment are demanding that the war escalate. In the face of massive and overwhelming popular opposition, US imperialism is on track to expand the war in the Middle East. Trump Religion Commission attacks separation of church and state, by Patrick Martin. A Religious Liberty Commission appointed by President Trump issued its 224-page draft report Friday, June 26, denouncing the separation of church and state and recommending dozens of actions to force fundamentalist Christian dogma into public schools and other government institutions. The effort to promote right-wing political and religious indoctrination is being carried out under the rubric of defending the First Amendment, although that history-making document begins, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, end quote. In reality, the First Amendment is being repealed in favour of theocracy, with religion crammed down the throats of schoolchildren in states like Texas, whose Lieutenant Governor, Dan Patrick, is chair of Trump's commission. The state has just issued a required reading list for elementary school children, which includes sections of the Bible, some to be read out loud in class. The state is also posting the Ten Commandments in every classroom. At a press conference releasing the report, Patrick threatened punishment of any public official who criticised a religious practice as violating the separation of church and state. Speaking for religious fundamentalists, he said that such officials, whether in schools, the military, government offices, or elsewhere, would be compelled to, quote, point out exactly where you have violated the Constitution, because you have not, and from this day forward, that phrase should have no power over people of all faiths ever again in America, end quote. In a justly famous presidential letter in 1802 to the Danbury Baptists, Thomas Jefferson wrote that the First Amendment had created a, quote, wall of separation between church and state, end quote, words that have been cited repeatedly in court decisions throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. In a landmark 1879 case, Reynold v. United States, the Supreme Court held that while the U.S. government was prohibited by the First Amendment from regulating the beliefs of the Mormon Church, it could prohibit such actions as plural marriage, just as it could prohibit human sacrifice or other conduct disruptive of public order. After citing Jefferson's letter, the court's unanimous 9-0 ruling declared that it was impossible to consider, quote, the professed doctrines of religious belief superior to the law of the land, and in effect to permit every citizen to become a law unto himself, end quote. The Religious Liberty Commission report attacks the Jefferson letter, declares the separation of church and state to be an invention of liberal justices of the Warren Court in the 1950s, and perverts the history of the founding of the American Republic and the significance of the First Amendment. One would not know, ploughing through the 224-page report, that 10 of the original 13 states had established churches at the time of the adoption of the Constitution: Congregationalist in New England, Anglican Episcopalian in the southern slave states, and New York. Only Rhode Island, founded by dissenters fleeing Puritan Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, heavily Quaker, had no established church. But by the early 19th century, under the impulse given by the Revolution and the Bill of Rights, all states had disestablished their churches, cutting off the flow of public money into church coffers, creating, indeed, Jefferson's wall of separation. As the public school system developed, religious education in the classroom faded out, banned outright in 1825 by the New York City Council, and became the purview of private religious schools and churches. The Trump Commission's report ignores this history and invents its own, according to which secularism was imported into the United States in the 1950s under the influence of European intellectuals like Jean-Paul Sartre, Michel Foucault, and Friedrich Nietzsche. Why this purportedly foreign doctrine was then supposedly embraced by the Warren Court, the authors of the report do not explain, nor does it make any sense, historically or factually. Like all such official documents, what is left out of the Religious Liberty Report is in many ways even more revealing than the lies, distortions, and false arguments that it contains. There is no mention of deism, the quasi-atheist agnosticism of Jefferson and many other founding fathers. Indeed, the words atheism, agnosticism, and unbelief simply do not appear. There is no reference to the fact that no religion is the fastest growing belief structure in America. Instead, fundamentalist Christianity is treated as a dominant religious viewpoint, or at least the one which the authors of the report want to make dominant. The report denounces anti-Semitism, described in such a way that it refers mainly to criticism of the State of Israel, but never mentions Islamophobia, a form of bigotry that has engulfed large sections of the Republican Party, particularly in Texas. Critics of the commission, including from more liberal and interfaith groups, as well as advocates of secularism and atheism, have pointed out that the Trump Commission is packed with hand raisers for the Christian right, all of them, of course, political backers of Trump, or they would not have been selected. Besides Lieutenant Governor Patrick, the vice chair is former Trump cabinet official Ben Carson. Other members include the Reverend Franklin Graham, son of evangelist Billy Graham, Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York, Kelly Shackelford, CEO and chief counsel for First Liberty Institute, the billionaire-backed legal shop for lawsuits challenging gay rights and other offences against Christian fundamentalism, Paula White Cain, Trump's personal pastor. And let us not forget that notable constitutional and theological expert, Phil McGraw, television personality Dr. Phil, whose qualifications as a defender of democratic rights are no better than his fellow commissioners. Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch, a plaintiff in a lawsuit by liberal and interfaith groups challenging the composition of the commission, said in a statement that its report, quote, reflects the narrow Christian nationalist worldview of the illegitimate commission, a betrayal of the original intention of the promise of religious freedom guaranteed in the First Amendment. The report and the commission behind it fail to represent and uplift the importance of religious diversity and tolerance for all faiths in our country, not just a special chosen few. The report is a wish list of divisive, unpopular ideas far-right religious groups have pushed for years, end quote. The commission issued, quote, 12 key recommendations to strengthen religious liberty for all Americans, end quote, which effectively require all departments of the federal government to intervene against the non-existent persecution of religious Americans. This includes the creation of snitch lines for anonymous reporting of, quote, religious liberty violations, end quote, the repeal of the Johnson Amendment, a legal provision that bars tax-exempt organizations like churches from endorsing and donating to political candidates, and allowing far wider use of religious exemptions from vaccination, particularly for members of the military. As opposed to the absurd portrayal of Christianity being under attack from the government, in no other advanced capitalist country is there such an assiduous promotion of the Judeo-Christian heritage, the real crisis of the religious establishment is the growing popular rejection of all forms of religion, particularly among young people, where non-belief in God is by far the largest segment of the population. A series of Supreme Court decisions over the last 15 years has sought to counter the impact of the rising tide of secularism and the growing support for democratic rights of gays, lesbians, Muslims, and other minorities, which are anathema to the Christian fascists. Moreover, among military intelligence officials and the decisive sections of the super-rich, there is a clear understanding that religious illusions are vital for the mobilization of the American population in imperialist wars, particularly those of the future, in which millions could be forced to give their lives. For these articles and more, visit the World Socialist website, wsws.org. This has been Jenny Campbell.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.